Hello, this is Kyle Jones. Tonight we're doing a class on skepticism, what it is, the difference between philosophical skepticism as bred in the 18th, 19th centuries, and it's to its full form, and its echo into the 21st century, versus empirical skepticism, which is a true, I personally believe, a scientific method that is valid, that leads somewhere, and causes for good ground to be established in the thought process. I'd also like to address real quickly that this lecture is going to be based on skepticism as a religion, coming out of that, and how it is it has become an academic freedom for ignorance, if you will. It's my personal opinion, and I believe this lecture will bring that to light. I'd like to go to the Barnhart Dictionary of Etymology, the subtitle, The Origins of American English Words by Robert K. Barnhart. You should get this. It's about $60 at any Barnes & Nobles or Borders. You can go out and check it out. It's worth its salt. The definition for skeptic, as we have in the Barnhart, was first dubbed in 1587 as a member of an ancient Greek school, from this the Greek philosopher Pyrrho, that doubted the possibility of real knowledge. And it was borrowed through the Middle French, skeptique, or the Latin skepticus, the plural skeptici, which means the skeptics. And this is from the Greek skeptikos, the plural skeptikoi, literally meaning to inquire or to reflect. And this was assumed by the disciples of the ancient Greek philosopher, like I said, Pyrrho, as their distinctive name. And then we can go on from that. We have the root word skeptisthai, which means to reflect, to look, to view. And in all the rest of it, Barnhart goes into the origins of ick and ism as to where it was first dubbed in the English language. For a further brief treatment, you can go to the Wikipedia. Of course, I don't hold to everything as being referenced correctly or tried all the way. And for that reason, I could be a skeptic on that, and that is no problem with us not holding to a religion on it, as we'll see further that skepticism becomes a religion. But if you would like to look at the definition for skepticism, you'll see at least the statement that it's different in philosophical terms than it is empirical terms, or should I say philosophy versus science. I think the intention with Pyrrho, as well as with Parmenides, the dialogue, it's a Platonic dialogue again of Parmenides and Socrates, which is the early form, the watershedding, if you will, of the first thought process of skepticism. The idea that we would put a word out or a statement out by a man, the first idea that it causes tension in that. When something is said, it's taken seriously in the schools of philosophy and truth. And when one looks at a person's statement, they have to put it through the categories of thought, which have led to modern-day philosophy. Well, at least the 18th, 19th century, 20th century philosophy, early 20th century. We look at something and we categorize it, and we have to go through the testing process of tension, trial, and then synthesis. And then theme, anti-theme, theme. So there's always a tension to everything a man would say in the school of philosophy. But once something is tried, if it holds to its own, it can be considered an axiom, and from there we go forward. So there's nothing wrong with empirical skepticism. We need it. That's why we have our modern-day science to do the things that we do. There's nothing wrong with that. But when skepticism becomes a religion. And so for that reason, you might want to go to Wikipedia for just a brief treatment on that, and I'm going to address that anyway in this lecture. So look up skepticism in the Wikipedia and see what you see. All right, I'm going to read out of an earlier text to kind of start the idea of the skeptical school from, like I just said, the Platonic dialogues here. This one happens to be the title Parmenides, and it's a dialogue between Socrates and Parmenides. Let me just start off by reading a little excerpt of the dialogue. It's not really, I didn't give you the basis of it or or the completion of it. It's about maybe 1/8 into the story. So let me read from this dialogue. Parmenides says, "Then the absolute good and the beautiful and all which we conceive to be absolute ideas are unknown to us." Socrates says, "I'm afraid they are." Parmenides says, "Now we come to a still more fearful consequence." Socrates asks, "What is it?" Parmenides says, "You would say, no doubt, that if there is an absolute kind of knowledge, it is far more accurate than our knowledge, and the same of beauty and all the rest." Socrates says, "Yes." Parmenides says, "And if anything partakes of absolute knowledge, you would say that there is no one more likely than God to possess this most accurate knowledge." Socrates says, "Of course." Parmenides says, "Then will it be possible for God to know human things if he has absolute knowledge?" Socrates says, "Why not?" Parmenides says, "Because," says Parmenides, "we have agreed that those ideas are not relative to our world, nor our world to them, but each only to themselves." Socrates says, "Yes, we have agreed to that." So here's the categorization right here. This is why categories for human thought and the pairs of opposites, if you will, dualism, if you will, come into play a little bit in the dialogue, the beginning dialogue. Of course, Plato doesn't hold to that. He ultimately holds to the universal. But there is a form of duat that does exist in this, not in opposition, but that, remember, the duat we talked about is the reason precedes phusis, or nature. And logos preceded that. So logos is reason. It was the emanation of himself in the creation. But for this dialogue, we have the problem of categorization, and Aristotle took to that, and that was the reason why our schools are Aristotelian, and that is the basis of our educational system now, is that we put things into categories, and one cannot jump into the other field. Therefore, we have to be lent to a type of skepticism, because we can apply this technique of scientific empiricism to philosophical the dialogues of philosophy, or the outcome of philosophy through being a skeptic. Let me continue here. So Parmenides says, "Then if this most perfect mastership and this most accurate knowledge are with God, his mastership can never rule us, nor his knowledge know us or anything of our world. We do not rule the gods with our authority, nor do we know anything of the divine with our knowledge. And by the same reasoning, they, likewise being gods, are not our masters and have no knowledge of human affairs." Socrates, "But surely this," said he, "is a most amazing argument if it makes us deprive God of knowledge." Quote, "And yet, Socrates," says Parmenides, "these difficulties and many more besides are inseparable from the ideas. If these ideas of things exist, and we declare that each of them is an absolute idea, therefore he who hears such assertions is confused in his mind and argues that the ideas do not exist, and even if they do exist, cannot by any possibility be known by man. And he thinks that what he says is reasonable. And, as I was saying just now, he is amazingly hard to convince. Only a man of very great natural gifts will be able to understand that everything has a class and absolute essence. And only a still more wonderful man can find out all these facts and teach anyone else to analyze them properly and understand them." "I agree with you, Parmenides," says Socrates, "for what you say is very much to my mind. But on the other hand," says Parmenides, "if anyone with his mind fixed on all these objections and others like them denies the existence of ideas of things, and does not assume an idea under which each individual thing is classed, he will be quite at a loss, since he denies that the idea of each thing is always the same. And in this way, he will utterly destroy the power of carrying on discussion. You seem to have been well aware of this. Quite true, he said. So this is, I can continue on here. This is, matter of fact, I think that if you would get the dialogue of Parmenides, you do yourself well. Matter of fact, it's in the same book in the Loeb Classics that that Cratylus is. So we had just we're not wrapping up Cratylus either. We're not finishing it. We're just beginning, if you will, and we're in part seven now. But it's just a tremendous lecture series on the anatomy of will and name. Well, I would say get the Loeb Classic if you haven't already purchased the J.M. Cooper's Complete Works of Plato. Either one is fine, but I like the Loeb Classic because it has the Greek on the left page, and I can get to the root of the meaning of some of these things and apply them to the biblical New Testament. So anyway, this is a dialogue of ideas and not being able to be allowed in the idea realm. The idea being the, how do I say this? The idea would be the numinous, or the things that cannot be seen or sensed, the sensational or sensory category. And since that we are dealing in skepticism, or the beginning of it, we were looking for the empirical data necessary to process to lead to a conclusion. And already we have a division now of the philosophical or metaphysical world of what we call the numinous, and it is not in the same category as the phenomenal, or the phenomenon that which we can see. It's that which acts into our world. Later on, we'll see that Kant actually agreed and was a theist. And believe it or not, I did not, not that you would not believe I didn't know it or did know it, but the point of it is that in his philosophy, he said he could not calculate or compute God or theism into his rational skeptical world of philosophy, due to it being in the numinous, and that there comes a point where there's no longer logic that leads or lends itself from the empirical world to the world of ideas, should I say, or the metaphysical world, even though that Plato reversed this whole thing, and way long ago he was already saying that only we can understand the particulars in the empirical world is to understand the idea that preceded it, and that was considered your cosmological argument. Anyway, that's the kind of the premise. But let's start up now with our lecture. This was only a preface. The real title of this lecture is called The Religion of Skepticism, The Academic Cult of Ignorance. So from our prior statement concerning the school of Pyro, where it came from, and the watershedding, or the bringing about the school of skepticism or philosophy, using skepticism from the Platonic dialogue of Parmenides with Socrates, all the way up to 17th, 18th century, the world had been pretty much in agreement with the idea of what we've covered in the prior lecture concerning Cratylus as pothos, being the thing that we look forward to, but we don't have, the transcendent thing, and then the imminent thing, which is where we get the word emera, meaning the dawn of day is upon us, the morning star. And of course, that's another lecture concerning the Christ that's in you now, the dawn of morning star, the imminence of of reason. And that'll be something we'll continue. We had the false morning star called Luci Pharos, or Lucifer, the one who brings about light, the false, really the false light giver. but we'll discuss it later. This is all tying in. I guess I'm trying to say is this is one large word, one large doctrine. And another thing, real preface here, when I'm quoting these philosophers, do not think that these are completed forms of thought. not all the way. Some of them are really good. Some are really close. I'm only quoting them to get to a closer idea of truth. This is still a type of deductive syllogism as we speak and do this class. But when I'm speaking, do not take these things for the altruistic nature and take them on in your life, because they're not completed yet. And until this lecture series is completed, I would not take action. I would be a skeptic of the skeptics. So once again, the idea was that there was two different worlds, a transcendent world and the immanent world. Once again, in empiricism, empirical data, it's right in front of you, and to categorize in empirical way. And then in the metaphysical way, the things that transcend, that come from idea, motion, reason into this world. And we have the word tapenosis in the Greek for that, the one that comes down and touches us from the higher level, the transcendent. And I do believe if you study the metaphysical poets, Blake and John Donne in particular, even Milton, you're going to see a kind of a reactionism, maybe a reactionism to this philosophical school, that one cannot act upon the numinous or the metaphysical, that which is not able to be looked at as phenomenon in this world. And I think that was exactly what drove them all the way into their poetry and their actions, was the numinous. So their lives were a living, breathing answer to this type of movement. But anyway, we have the transcendent, the pothos, as I say, the things that we yearn for but we do not have, and the emera, or the immanent thing, that was the schools, that was the thing that that people held on to. Going back to the old world, once again, we have Plato as the idea. He had answered for this thing, that it doesn't matter in terms of if it be metaphysical, numinous, or in the real world was reflective of the numinous. So he had a cosmological viewpoint. He believed that it was the cosmos, an ordered arrangement, and that you could look back and see that the order in this world was only held together by the prima causa, or the cause and effect. For that reason, many of the skeptics, they could hold to that. But there was another argument against that later on, we'll see. So anyway, come on down here to around the 1700s, the 18th century. All men really held to that view, that Platonic and Aristotelian view. There was two different schools of thought, but one could help the other one to synthesize an idea. Hegel went on to say that time itself, though, with this phenomenal and noumenal realm, time itself and space itself, was God unfolding himself. So Hegel was kind of answering to this whole thing, that that you could see God in terms of he was not progressive, but that in his numinous way, he would show himself through the physical by unfolding himself in time, and that time and space themselves were really God. So this is an idea that had never been come about before this time. And with that said, there was never a progressive or evolutionary form of thinking. And this was, to some people who were Darwinists, coming in 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, were not liking that as much. And, anyway, that was the dialectic of Hegel. He said that there was, he said that there is a process that invokes tension. This tension, even though it is has to be dealt with in the Platonic view or the form by thesis, antithesis, and then synthesis, he says that all things still have an answer to them, that you don't have to be skeptical about it. You just have to act out the synthesis. You have to look at the facts, and they will be unfolded. Therefore, there was an idea of absolutism within Hegel. What we call in this, you can call it the polar tension. Parmenides said it was just being. So, but that was not specific enough for the 18th century mind. Okay, let's continue here. There is another sense here to Hegel when he brought about this term called Aufgehoben, which means the thing that is elevated to the next level, that which rises above the current difficulties. There is a thing of unfolding that when we have tension thesis, that there will always be the next thing to rise above. There always will be the unfolding of the answer. And that was it. So the supreme problem for Hegel, for people, was that always people are thinking outside of the object in the subjective world in philosophy and the metaphysical philosophy. Now he believed that that was the problem, the crux of it. But that these two, the subject and object, were a grammatical sequence, and one needed the other. So that's a reflection of the grander scheme. And so ultimately come down to this thing, the absolute subject is Hegel's reason. So what he was saying is when the absolute spirit is not distinct or divorced, it is not to be looked at as being something that is numinous for itself's sake. It is not divorced from our world, and so therefore it's not an absolute argument against that. It can't be. Now the complex argument against Hegel's the logic of Hegel was that if God is time and space unfolding in an accurate format, that being numinous bound to the phenomenal world or the sensational world, that which you can sense, then God himself is put in sequence. Therefore, he himself is actually bound in time. And how can God be bound in nature or phusis, that which unveils itself in time and space, and yet be will? And so the answer for that would be simply that the expression of God is the branch, the al-zimak in the Arabic. Jesus is the arm. He is the branch, the one who commits a tapenosis, where he reaches down and unfolds himself, or is unfolded as an expression of the essence of the Father, which is the term for mimesis, to mimic the thing. Jesus is not the verb, he's the noun, and it is the Father who works and wills in him. Therefore, this is the congruent act of mimesis later on that we've seen. We can study the Auerbach book, and we can study my lectures on mimesis. And that, once again, was one of the Platonic ideas. And ultimately, I'll say this, that Plato, out of all of these arguments, held the strongest. He ultimately held the universal stance that it is all cosmological and it comes from God. And it's a mimicry of from reason outside of the box of time and space to time and space. So we'll see later on that this is the Platonic view does answer this. But one of the tensions to this argument is that if God is space and time, then it takes on a type of pantheistic nature or viewpoint that Kant could ripped apart. He saw through that. So it's you're getting into a little bit more hypercritical view whenever you look at these higher reasonings that these men had. So with that said, the arm of God, the branch of God, is the answer for the time of the space of unfolding of the thing. But the essence still, in essence, would still have to fall under the categories of numinous, which Kant would get you on in terms of philosophy of skepticism and say, therefore, you cannot reason to God by classification. Not because he didn't believe in God. I said he is a theist. He ultimately was a theist in his belief system. So he did not deny everything that we're saying that Plato said. It's just in his classification of skepticism for academia, it cannot be reasoned. Therefore, you're gridlocked. So Kant had the better argument for that. So once again, Hegel said that he equated God as time and space unfolding, that therefore, Kant saw through that as not being the same classification. And I'm saying, and I'm kind of holding on to Plato, but I'll go further than Plato by the book of Job, where we see that the hand of Satan is nothing more than a tool, and he is in the nature of destruction, not in the will of destruction, only the Father will. So there's a separation in classification right there. So I'd kind of like to recap here a little bit with Immanuel Kant. His argument against Hegel was once again, Hegel had said that God was a type of unfolding, well, he was an unfolding, not progressive thing, which kind of lent himself to a pantheistic view, which was saying, you know, that God was time and was space. So, you know, we have the argument, the dangerous argument that that C.S. Lewis placed. He posited that that God cannot do all things. He cannot go against his own will, and he cannot be evil in his essence. And that was one of the ontological things, one of the essences of argument from the ontological point of view from Martin Heidegger. Heidegger did a tremendous ontological treatment called Being and Time, and that's that supports the essences concerning Kant, that you cannot classify an essence because it's not itself sensational. Essences is, it is an isness. It is what we call a substratum, or what we call the subject. You cannot classify that, as Kant said, because it's not in the sensational world, the empirical world. And so, anyway, this ultra pantheistic view that a lot of people would say that Hegel took on was deemed to be not worthy it was not deemed worthy to be held in the academic world of skepticism due to you cannot take the numinous and classify it in terms of the sensational. Therefore, Kant went higher and said that if God could be will, essence of idea, the numinous, he cannot be in the same movement of the empirical or the sensational, because he would contradict his own self. He could not be both nature or phusis, and be reason, logic, idea that governs that and precedes that. Once again, Kant was a theist, so he did believe in his metaphysical belief system of there was a God, had cause and effect, had idea, and did bring things into this world, but he could not categorize it. So the ultimate argument that Kant had was you cannot have these two worlds at the same time, which I would actually agree. The answer for that is in the Trinity, and that the Trinity is what gave the answer, and has always given the answer for the act of nature in phusis. That's the taponosis of Christ coming down as Alzamach, like I've said before, to enact, engage as noun the verb of the Father, the will. So in that, essence and will comes from the Father. Christ, being in mimicry of the Father, does the Father's will. And that's why Jesus said, it's not of my will, it's of my Father's will. So he placed himself in the phusis of the essential, which was God, like Aristotle has argued, as well as that your hand is not moving, movement's moving. The hand is reflective in mimicry or mimesis of the verb, movement of hand. And that's, once again, the story of Job. It was the phusis of Satan or Shatan, Shatan Eliad, or the hand of God was Satan. He did the physical destruction, but yet in its nature, the evil, if you will, where God himself, the Father, cannot do it, nor can Christ do evil work. Christ himself came to save, not to destroy. But it's the Father's will that will be done through Christ as the hand of God. So, and at the end of the book of Job, we see that Job said that, God, it was you that took all these things away. And the Bible says that in all that Job said in this, he did not sin against God. He said perfectly and said right. So this is a good example of answering to Kant. Now, it's interesting that after Kant's argument on this, that you have to have a classification and that the two cannot work together, you cannot fuse the two together, there has never been a greater argument against the anti-Christic world or the anti-God world in terms of classification of numinous into the empirical world. So after that, it broke apart. And interestingly enough, at that time, because you could not put those two classifications together in terms of the philosophical world, the church itself, and I don't say all the church, but by and large, the church itself started to fall apart as well, and it did not engage in any more academic or higher forms of academic argumentation, or should I say, it was not fused with the philosophical world anymore. So at that point, the academic world shut out the church in terms of a logical body of organon of thought process. So it's interesting that that I've never read it before, but that's exactly what it comes down to, that the Trinity, particularly the Father-Son relationship, answers to this problem. And interestingly enough, the answer for the al-zamak, or the arm of the branch of God, the Father, the essence to the empirical or the sensational, it is Christ himself who is the that answers to the idea of Plato's world and concerning idea of to pregnancy to a, from essential to pregnancy particulars, and it is in that world, that ontological world, that Christ did echo the answer to the whole Greek world and to the Greek thought and process all the way up to Kant. So Christ himself actually reversed the idea of Kant and did give the answer. So anyway, in Mimesis, the hand of God, the Eliyad, Jesus, al-Zamak, if you will, did answer for that in Mimesis. So I would say that that there has never been a greater argument against the church. And once again, because Kant said that the all sensations have to be classified, this is a sensation in terms of essential nature of the Christ that came, who did the bidding of the Father, and he did come in the physical form, and he did call himself of the numinous, and he is the numinous. So it is the numinous speaking, and he showed us how to walk. So this is another lecture for walking, the bade to abide, and this takes away the Aristotelian point of view of just classification of living and breathing in faith. So as a final recap concerning skepticism, the point of it is you cannot define skepticism in a philosophical sense until you've defined Immanuel Kant. It is crack shot toward the Christian church, or the believing body of thinkers, believers, that focus their mind on the numinous. So to answer the question of what a philosophical skeptic is, it is a person who has to fall in the category of sensational thinking that looks at the numinous, okay, as skeptical, which means that we cannot input that into the sensational category of thought. And that's where it's left off at. And from that, like I said, there has not been any other argument in terms how do I say it, against the skeptic right, in terms of classification of the here and now. But the point of it being is that the topics that we have already covered in terms of Christianity, and actually Plato, really they recap the Kantian argument. It has to do with you apply yourself in the laws of mimesis, and from that point there's no argument. Once again, Kant was a theist. He accepted that he and his full body of thought, as a whole human being, did believe in a God, and it was the skeptic who, if they take on skepticism as a religion and an overwhelmed body of thought for their self, their person, they will be left not fully formed and fully fit. This is something that is a travesty for people who want to take on that notion.